here on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Curtis B. Wayne, your host, here on the 20th of February, 2011. You numerologists can go crazy about that. 2002, 2011, it all adds up to 8. It's a number 8 day, a day of infinite possibilities. Brought to you this Sunday afternoon by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor. And this is not just ad copy. This is true, really. That's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, check them out on the web at HearstRanch.com. Thank you, Hearst Ranch. Hold on a second. I'm going to switch my phones because this is funky and weird. So much better. Thank you. I was sounding very basso profundo there for a moment. Sustainable, grass-fed, the natural environment, living green, the world of sustainability, design revolutions in the making. All of this comes directly from the lecturing and the writings of Richard Buckminster Fuller, Bucky Fuller, whom we fondly remember. He lived from 1895 until in the early 1980s. Most of us of a certain age remember him as a very old man, but he became an agent for change starting in the 1920s with his experiments in doing more with less in terms of using natural resources. His concept of this planet reduces to his notion of it being spaceship Earth. It's one of his themes, that we are all astronauts. And some of his innovations and inventions include the geodesic dome, his concept of tensile integrity or tensegrity, very lightweight structures where the components are working only in compression or by being stretched, only tension and compression. Whereas in a conventional building, we have bending stresses and shear stresses, all sorts of forces creating moment or bending conditions in a tensegrity structure like a geodesic dome. None of that applies. Everything is pure compression or pure tension. Another thing that he devised was the Dymaxion car, a teardrop-shaped vehicle seating 9 people, the blunt end on the front and the trailing thin edge with 2 drive wheels in the front and 1 wheel in the back that was steering the craft. He thought of it more as a vehicle that could be used on highways or on rail, not necessarily as a car, not as a car as cars were understood. And you could park it by heading nose first into a parking lot, then pulling the back steering wheel hard over at 90 degrees to the curb and pulling straight away in. Now, you know that one of the themes here in Burning in the House is to select appropriate music for us to help think about the ideas that are being talked about. But when it comes to Bucky Fuller, really, it's all about words and more words. It's very difficult to put music to Bucky's ideas. So let's just let Bucky speak for himself. Jack, if you could play the next track.
People say to me, I wonder what it'd be like to be on a spaceship. And I say to you, you don't really realize what you're doing. Because everybody is an astronaut. You all live aboard a beautiful little spaceship called Earth.
I think that we're some kind of final examination as to whether human beings are qualified to take on the responsibility we desire to be entrusted with. And this is not a matter of examination of the types of governments, nothing to do with politics, nothing to do with the economic system. It's to do with the individual. Does the individual have the courage to really go along with the truth?
Therefore, the only way we can possibly take care of everybody is through a design revolution, doing more with less.
It is highly feasible
to take care of all of humanity at a higher standard of living without having anybody profit at the expense of another, so everybody can enjoy the whole earth.
The whole earth. If you're a history buff, you might remember the Whole Earth catalog. Very popular. It fed on these synergistic ideas. A synergy, again, is another Bucky Fuller term. He invented a lot of words. He found it necessary to invent words because there weren't words to convey these ideas. Synergy is a synthesis of different energies. A synergistic world is where everything is working together in harmony. Oh gosh, that's like sustainable design, isn't it? So we have a great debt, a debt of honor in some ways, to carry forward these ideas. Now, Bucky always said that he felt that he was at least 50 years ahead of where society was ready to carry out these ideas that he was putting forth into the world. To a certain extent, he was correct. In a couple of cases, which we'll hear in a couple later clips from him, he missed the date by more than 50 years. Let's hear the next clip, if we could. Thank you.
I'm quite confident that if I'm any significance or use at all, it's because I'm really a demonstration of what an average healthy human being really does have in the way of faculties and resources, that when the individual makes up his mind really to go along with whatever the truth and the challenges may be, and not try to solve things in the terms of what the going game of money or politics may be. I'd just like to emphasize that I think that I'm only a manifest of what evolution is up to. There has to be an X and has to be a Y character that does such and such.
Yeah.
And that I, by good fortune, happen to be in a sort of a frontier position.
Yes.
Really in a frontier position, because I, in a sense, was almost, had been thrown out of the regular patterns. Yeah. It seemed to be unwanted, so that really was exile.
Yeah.
And simply with the enormous perspective that an exile has of looking things over as a whole,
yes.
I was able to realize that humanity had arrived at some point of transformation, a great threshold across, in view of the fact that all humans were born naked, absolutely helpless, ignorant. We obviously had to find our way, and we had to find our way by trial and error, gradually to discover that we have mind, that mind can discover principles, and the principles themselves are something that cannot be apprehended just by brains of any other creature, because brains are always and only coordinating the information input from the touching, the smelling, the hearing, the seeing, and making up packages of those inputs. But mind discovers relationships existing between special case packages that are not in the data of any of the discoveries of science have been in these interrelationships that are not in any of the data of any of the special case. Mm-hmm. And that's all the brain can ever deal with, is always the special case information. So that these principles discovered by mind turn out then to be principles. And a principle has no inherent beginning and end, and they do not get accredited by science as a scientific principle if there's ever an exception found. So they are, by definition, inherently eternal. Now, everything the brain deals in is terminal, finite. So that we have mind and mind alone, which the human beings have, that no other phenomenon we know in the universe has, which has some access to some eternal principles operating in the universe. And we find these eternal principles themselves are, none of them have ever been found to contradict another. Not only do they not contradict one another, but they're all inter-accommodative. That is, they're all being eternal, they're concurrently, all concurrently operative. They do not interfere with them. Some of them then augment one another at exponential rates. When you get a complex of clearly differentiated behaviors that all inter-accommodate one another, this would be called a design. That's what I mean by a design, in contrast to their being disorderly and interfering with one another. So the human mind has apparently gradually been pulling the curtain aside and discovering some of the great design of the universe itself. I said, I came at a moment when I began to be absolutely astonished by being exiled by society, in a sense. I saw that those human beings were terribly preoccupied with the games of finding out what is so, and having enormous ignorance of yesterday, feeling that you're made hungry. You don't make yourself hungry. It's not quite a piece of design that we are. And people have not found seemingly enough to eat, and not enough. So they've been seeing the world as a game of a negative, where a man's supposed to be a failure and had to prove himself an exception to live. And I could see that the principles really operating on the universe indicated very, very properly that he was here for a very important function, and he had to discover his mind. And realizing that about the time that I'm in this kind of awareness, that we had to invent a lot of words to describe our communicators, you and I are sitting here doing.
Mm-hmm.
The Oxford Dictionary, ladies and gentlemen, had about 100,000 words, indicating that little human beings in the trial and error have discovered over 100,000 nuances of information that were so different that they really needed their own word. Mm-hmm. And that they've been able to agree on 100,000 words, knowing how difficult it is for human beings to come to an agreement that agreed 100,000 words, again seemed to me an incredible victory. Mm-hmm. That I felt then that here I was coming into a picture of man on board of our planet after millions of years having this beautiful vocabulary, so you and I can communicate these experiences, mm-hmm. that out of those experiences we can discover principles, and we're here to employ those principles.
Wow. That was pretty typical of the kind of lecture or conversation that Bucky Fuller was known for. A totally rapid fire, just a barrage of ideas and thoughts cycling around and around and around. There are just a few things that I wanted to remark on. It's a good thing that these programs are available as podcasts, because you're going to have to listen to that one again. I mean, there's so much stuff in there. It's very dense. He talks about design as being a set of decisions that are not contradictory, which is one of the things that we try to accomplish in sustainable architecture, where there's a balance of technologies in working with nature. Another concept that he has is, you know, the spaceship Earth. We're astronauts. That our system of resources is, to a certain extent, if the Earth is a spaceship, which in a certain way it is, traveling through the cosmos, circling our sun, we have a closed system of resources, and we should... Well, there are many parts to this. He talks about the game, where some people are gaming the system to their own advantage instead of sharing their little corner of the Earth's resources with other people in other places. It was something that especially offended his sense of egalitarianism, which gets into political ramifications. And I think in the next little track we might hear a little bit about politics, but we're not quite ready to go there yet. But Bucky Fuller set the stage with so many ideas that we've now picked up in terms of ecology, which is transmogrified into the world of sustainability and green living. But back in the late 1950s and 60s, we talked about ecological balance, not harming the environment, but rather working with them. That's a theme that's still very much current and still very much with us. The world game that he introduced in his studios with his students was intellectual exercise looking at where the resources in the world happen to be located and where are they needed and how could there be an equitable distribution of resources from one part of the planet, from one part of spaceship Earth to another, so that all people could benefit in an equal way from all of the resources of our little blue ball going through the universe. Which is a very noble idea. Politically, that's almost impossible to bring about. Although recently, in a press report of a meeting of the G5, a representative from Brazil asked, and this is an old question that has come up again and again, especially in the context of Bucky Fuller's Dymaxian worldview, which is to say that we are equally sharing resources and also capabilities. Representative from Brazil asked, when are the industrial nations, those who use the natural resources, which are provided to them fairly cheaply, and then produce industrialized products, which then the people in the poorer countries, but who have natural resources, have to buy back at a premium? When are the industrial nations going to do something for the less developed countries? And that's a very pithy and difficult project to undertake. From a design point of view, the whole idea that we can, in fact, step aside from politics and just simply, as architects and designers, create a better world, irrespective of, one, the program that we're given by the clients, but rather have a higher order of social contract, which is something that goes around in architectural circles, that implied in the licensing of design professionals, implied in that licensing is that we have a higher calling, we have a social contract, we have a social obligation to society at large, because because to a certain degree, we are granted a great deal of authority as architects. So we have a social contract with the world at large to make the place better than it was when we first encountered it. Let's hear a little bit more from Bucky.
Actual measurement of the technology you do need to make man a success. Mm-hmm. I now know it's highly feasible. We have the resources, we have the knowledge. Mm-hmm. The metals have not been lost of in mind. They simply come out and get melted out to take one Cadillac, melt it up and get out two Japanese cars. Price is good. Yes, uh-huh. So that what we keep circulating, mm-hmm. I now know with the resources we already mined, the knowledge we already have, is highly feasible to take care of all of humanity mm-hmm. at a higher standard than anyone's ever known.
Yeah.
And it can be done by 1985. Uh-huh. And we now know actually the critical path of how we phase out the fossil fuels burning, how we phase out the nuclear, how we do bring in the wind power, how we do bring in the hydrogen powers and so forth, and mm-hmm. it actually can be done by 1985. I knew that because I made the measurements before. Now I have really a large team and been able to certify this, so it's going to become a public matter fairly rapidly. I like to use an example. One communication satellite weighing 1/4 ton is outperforming the transoceanic communication capability of 175,000 tons of copper cable.
That's right.
That's the rate of gain of the more or less thing. It's not just one Cadillac into two Japanese, but very exponential rate. I say, we're going to have a revolution of blood, and everybody loses then.
Yeah.
Or it's going to be a design revolution where we do use the ephemeral rates. We do more or less. We do get all humanity successful by 1985. I take very deep sense of responsibility that you and I are invited to be on the air to communicate to a number of people.
Yes.
Therefore, I say, the most important thing is how do we get all of humanity to find out what it is all about in the shortest possible time that man does have the option to make it. He didn't know it, but now he has.
Okay.
I think we're going to discover that nobody owns anything.
Wow. We're about to discover that nobody owns anything. It all belongs to all of us. That was an interview. It was a cable TV interview in 1971. So he kind of blew his prognostication there, thinking that all of this was going to be in place by 1995. Of course, in 1971, 1995 was impossibly in the future. Now we look back at 1995 and say, huh? Well, it hasn't happened yet. But he's given us this challenge that we have this obligation because we have the awareness of the possibilities of what can happen to spread the word and partake in this design revolution of which he spoke there. Design revolution where everyone wins, nobody loses. His notion is that there is plenty for everyone. Some do not have to lose if others win. But with the proper redistribution of resources, that is industrial tools, doing more with less, his example there of a geosynchronous communication satellite seems rather trivial these days. But in 1971, we didn't have microelectronics. The integrated circuit chip had just been recently introduced. You couldn't even get a pocket calculator in 1971. A little bit later, you could get a calculator that cost $150 in 72, 73, that only did addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division, didn't do square roots, and it didn't do floating point multiplication or division. It was integers only. And it was incredibly expensive. $150 in 1972 would have paid your rent in a fairly nice one-bedroom in the Lower East Side. Wow. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about Bucky Fuller's legacy, because time and again, we come across the issue of recycling, repurposing, and sustaining those resources that have come to us over the centuries, where a structure that has any sort of life should, and I put that in quotes, should be maintained, should be repurposed, recycled, should be lovingly incorporated into some kind of new structure. But that is not always possible. And thinking on the one hand of the legacy of Bucky Fuller, for whom I, when I was a younger man, held great affection, and now look back at that challenge that he laid out for all of us, and I say, well, he was an old man and was full of those late ideas of let's just get it done. Now, I'm in the middle of my career, and I look back and I say, when I was young and I was yearning to do something more, I looked at Bucky and say, yes, we can do it. Now I say, yes, we can do it, but it might take a little while. Let's have a true musical break, and we'll come back and talk about a structure in Westchester that should be preserved, and perhaps it can and perhaps it cannot. Hold on.
My life, I'm a lot like you were. Old man, look at my life, I'm a lot like you were. Old man, look at my life, 24 and there's so much more. Live alone in a paradise that makes me think of two. Love lost, such a cost. Give me things that don't get lost, like a coin that won't get tossed, rolling home to you. Doesn't mean that much to me, to mean that much to you. I've been first and last, look at how the time goes past, but I'm all alone at last, rolling home.
Neil Young, old man, look at my life. Hey, Tom, are you there?
I'm here.
Hey, Thomas Lee, architect from Westchester. Welcome to Burning Down the House.
Thank you, Curtis.
We have to do a little housekeeping here first. We're brought to you this Sunday by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the central California coast. They have over 151,000 acres of grassland on the Pacific Ocean. I mean, think about that, Tom. That's bigger than all five boroughs of New York. So it is pretty friggin' awesome, don't you think?
It's great for a cow.
It's great for the cowboys, and it's great for us, because the result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape of that California coastline. More information at HearstRanch.com. Thank you, Hearst people. We love you. You are a great supporter of Heritage Radio Network. Now, in full disclosure, Tom and I worked together for several years at IVI, which is arguably the world's most, the world's best third-party reviewer of other people's work. We spend a lot of time looking at other architects' contract documents and following the progress of buildings through construction and reporting the results to the construction lenders who are funding this, which, of course, the owners of the buildings paid for, sometimes unhappily, because we had unfortunate things to report about the progress of their projects. Nevertheless, it was a great education, and it has instilled in both Tom and in me a real sense of balance and understanding of how things can and should or might go together in the built environment, which most architects in an ordinary career are not exposed to such a great degree. And so welcome. Welcome to Burning Down the House. I'm glad you could join us. What really interested me is that you wrote on Facebook, which is how we all communicate now in the new world with social networking, about the Melbourne farmhouse in Yorktown, which I understand that you had the opportunity to visit.
I did. The town clerk had of the town of Yorktown had made some comments in the local newspaper, North County News, about the history of the house, and that some of the local residents were upset that it was slated for demolition. Comments range from everything from the school district doesn't know how to maintain their building.
Well, how is it that the school district had this pre-revolutionary house?
It is, from what we understand, it was built around the 1810-1830s, 40 years after the Revolution, by a family local to the area, the Strang family, who may have moved up from Lower Westchester up into the area. Going back onto Ancestry.com, there was a very long extended family that had moved into the area. They were primarily farmers. They cleared the land of trees to create the farmland.
They had a dairy farm, right?
I'm not quite sure of that. I think it is dairy, but I think there was a large prevalence for growing crops in this area as well. So from what we looked at the Melbourne house, the town clerk had expressed an interest of using the house as an educational tool for the local students to come in and explore the history of the house, how it was put together, to find out how old the house really was. The Yorktown High School and the Yorktown Middle School are both within walking distance of the house. The house was used as the school administration offices for quite some time. The former owner, I believe, had donated the house in the late 1950s to the school to use for their facilities at about the same time the Yorktown High School was being constructed.
Okay, what's this house look like today? So, I mean, what I'm understanding is that there was a house, it was on a property, it came into the possession of the school district, and they built some schools on it, and this old house had just been sitting there through the years. And what's it like now?
The house has aluminum siding on it, which is hiding a lot of the existing conditions. From the outside, it looks like a very large, white-styled, almost Victorian-style house with all the some of the flourishes that you may find in a older Victorian house. The house in the picture on the North County News actually shows a tower structure on the front of it over the front door. That tower structure is no longer attached to the house. It may have been removed. It may have been removed as part of a fire, and the roof was rebuilt. We were figuring that the original house was built between 1810 and 1830, with a subsequent addition put on in the 1860-1870s, which was about the Queen Victorian era, and the family had been established for 50, 60 years by then and had accumulated land and wealth, and for the period wanted to modernize their house.
Yeah.
When we toured the inside of the house,
Just hold on. In terms of the original provenance of the house, we're talking about a house that's not a whole lot older than a lot of the formerly tenement housing that's on the Lower East Side that was built in the late 30s, 1840s, which have been kept up and have been continually lived in pretty much in Lower Manhattan. So that, I mean, there's a similarity in terms of time frame.
If you were looking at a timeline, there are portions of the house that were built by hand. The beams were hand hewn, and then as the railroad came into existence in Yorktown, which allowed the farmers and of the local area to bring their crops to the train station, and they took them into New York City and Lower Manhattan to sell.
Uh-huh.
Running water then became possible, electricity after that. We found evidence of several of the fireplaces that were in the house had marble fronts on them, which was quite expensive at the time. But the administrators didn't know the type of grill work that was on the front of the fireplace. And I looked at it closely, and the grill work had a large circle in it. Up in this area of Westchester, during the time of the Civil War, there was a large cast iron foundry complex that was putting out everything from plows to fireplaces to all manner of metal household items. I surmise that they had little cast iron stoves out in front of these fireplaces, and it was just primarily a flue connection.
There are
two existing brick chimneys in the house. We don't see any attachments to them. They're not connected. The fireplaces don't have any hearths behind them. So the house was renovated long after the fireplace was put in and disconnected. Maybe during a time it was converted to an office building from a house.
So what you're describing is a repository of all sorts of historically interesting goodies here and there. These marble mantel fronts and the inserts that indicate that there may have been Franklin stoves with flue inserts that went through them into the chimneys and hand-hewn beams. And now the diehard sustainable people and preservation people would have us believe that at all costs
that we should save,
we should save them. Hold that thought. Let's have a little break and get back to why maybe we can't.
Welcome. Yeah. Tears for Fears. Everybody wants to rule the world.
Song.
Thank you. Well, we try our best. Everybody wants to rule the world. The preservationists
want to
set the rules.
Nothing lasts forever.
Nothing lasts. That's true. I mean, there's so much wisdom in popular music. So this is Burning Down the House for Sunday, 20th of February, 2011, brought to you by Hearst Ranch. And Tom Lee is with us, architect. You're in Poughkeepsie?
Peekskill.
One of those P-towns up there. Peekskill has had a real revival. I have to say, that old mill town, it was really down and out, and all sorts of great things are happening up there. We can talk about that, in a little bit. I'd like to hear more about that. But first, tell us what you observed when you went to look at the Melbourne farmhouse there in Yorktown.
Well, this house is not a really high Victorian house. There's not a whole lot of extensive details in the house. This was a simple farmhouse that had been expanded over time. They had plaster walls, but plaster walls were the state-of-the-art at the time. There were some ornate wood moldings, but in the overall scheme of things, the original 1810 house had been renovated. They took out the rear simple stairs from the main level up to the bedroom level and put in a much wider, almost ornate stair in the center hall colonial, which is basically what they made it into. And it had a mahogany railing going up the one side with large newel posts at the top and bottom, which was common to the 1860s,
1870s, 1880s. Absolutely. Nothing spectacular about that.
Nothing spectacular. They were run-of-the-mill. They were very simple. There wasn't, like I said, there wasn't a whole lot of ornate molding.
Sure.
The windows along the upper bedroom areas consisted of 6x6 window panes. There were also 4x4 window panes. But when I started looking at some of the windows, some of them were replacement windows that had the spring-type guides on the side to help them raise and lower. But some of the older windows actually had the cloth rope,
which
has a counterweight buried inside the frame.
Yep. So a mixed bag of new 20th century windows and original 19th century sash cord and counterweight windows with true divided lights.
And they were single pane. There weren't any. This house was not energy efficient.
Right.
In the sense of modern times.
Yeah, we wouldn't expect that, though.
Which is one of the considerations you have when you're trying to restore a historic home. The other issue in this house is that it was balloon framed, which meant that the studs that held up the outside walls went from the top of the foundation up to the eave of the roof, which had no blocking in the middle of it to prevent any fire or smoke if an event should occur on a lower level from going up into the attic and burning down the rest of the house, which...
Right.
In this case, we do believe that the roof had been burned off in a previous fire.
Yeah, that was a construction style that was very popular in the 1860s because it was very fast. You could get the roof on and then stick in the second floor structure afterwards.
A lot of it had to do with the barn-type framing of the time.
Uh-huh.
The connections that we had found up in the attic area. There were joists that were tied into the beams by first creating a square notch in the beam and then inserting the joist like a peg. There were no visible nails or bolts being
wow.
held. This was all
mortised together.
Mortise and tendon.
Mm-hmm.
But that was in the old portion of the house. The other portion of the house, the much newer side, had more... modern lumber. It was more nominal size, 2x4, 2x6, versus the older type lumber that was actually 2 inches wide by 6 or 5 inch, 5.5 inches deep. the roof was much newer, that it had true nominal lumber.
Modern dressed lumber, which is not a true 2x, but 1.5x something, yes.
Right. The collar ties that ran across the top of the attic were pieces of tongue groove flooring that were put up there.
So a real mixed bag.
Real mixed bag. And if the town was going to consider, or the school district was going to consider renovating it, they would literally have to take it down to its frame, because we examined some of the beams that were under the aluminum siding, and we found them to be rotted at the sill line. You have to basically support the house and remove the sill plate to put in new sill plates, new anchor bolts. The foundation was fieldstone with a lot of rubble rock in the middle of it,
sure,
and a lot of cement.
Yeah, not surprising. Sure.
And over time, even the cement starts to flake away and become sandy.
Sure,
because the mortar falls out.
There's no reinforcing holding it together.
In fact, one section of the fieldstone foundation appeared to collapse outward.
Ouch.
The facility engineer for the school had thought that there may be a cistern next to the house or a former outhouse location.
It sounds more like a cistern to collect rainwater from the roof.
I think it's more of a cistern because it looks like it was right near the former kitchen.
Yeah, perfect.
Of the house.
Yeah, something that all of us sustainability freaks would love to see and restore. But in this case, it caused as the walls of that dry well, that cistern, which is what a cistern is, it's a place to collect rainwater, eroded. The foundation wall went with it. Ouch. Ouch.
Ouch. So this house isn't even a good case study for this old house, the TV show. The estimates of repair were well into the low hundreds to bring it back to a usable state.
Uh-huh. And how many square feet is the house?
I'm thinking it is 50, 60 feet long by 30, 36 feet deep, two stories high. It's got about a 5-on-12 roof on it.
So, let's see, 50 feet by
1,800 per floor.
30 feet, 1,500, 3 times 2... Oh, it's
36 to 4,000.
It's a 4,000 square foot house.
Plus, it had a basement that was being used for storage, mechanical, and in some cases, they were using it for a children's educational area.
Yeah. So, in other words, in this economy, where there's plenty of labor available, lots of underemployed carpenters, you could build a brand new house with that amount of square footage for about $500,000.
You could also do likewise with a modular building.
Oh, sure. You could probably do it for even less with a house composed of parts that came from a factory someplace and were trekked on flatbeds.
And craned into place.
Right. So economically, you have to say, well, where's the value of saving this house? I mean, it becomes an almost religious sort of exercise then at that point, doesn't it?
It does. I'm actually a graduate of Yorktown High School, so I had seen this house all through my high school years. I may have been gone inside it once or twice. But I also had passed by this house on my way to my elementary school on a school bus. So from 1965 or so to 1974, I passed by this house. It was being used as an office building. when I was going to the high school, I also attended the local technical center, or BOCES, Board of Cooperative Education Services, for architectural drafting. And when I was going there, the BOCES campus used an old house on their campus as offices. And it was a great experimental learning laboratory, because they took the carpenters in the carpentry class, they took the electricians in the electrical class, the plumbers in the plumbing class, and the architectural class, to all go to this house, and we measured it, we drew plans of it, the plumbers did plumbing work in it, the electricians did, so on and so forth.
So it became a living laboratory.
A living laboratory.
But this particular house, the Melbourne house,
this would have been a perfect laboratory for that type of situation.
Would have been. But they kind of let it linger a little bit too long. Let's catch our breaths, have a little bit, two, 3 minutes of a little more music, and come back and talk about what comes next.
Service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune into The Food Scene Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network. Hosted by Michael Harlan Turkel, photo editor of Edible Brooklyn and Edible Manhattan magazines, he'll further explore the amalgamation of food and art by talking to artists from a multitude of media. Guests will range from photographers, food stylists, interior architects for restaurants, industrial designers, all the players that make you want to eat with your eyes. Get ready to feast your ears. Every Tuesday at 3 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Hey, I got to listen to that. That sounds really good, Jack. You got to put me together with what's his name? Turkel?
Michael Harlan Turkel.
I don't think he was at the HRN party. I did not meet him.
Relatively new to the station.
Well, that's good. Interior architects, that gets me salivating because that's part of our turf. Oh, this is burning down the house with Tom Lee, architect from Peekskill. Yeah, we do interior architecture, don't we? Like all the time.
long time.
To make it, you know, I have this sinking feeling about this poor Melbourne farmhouse. I just want to clarify. A question came up. The building that you were talking about that the Voces people used as a living laboratory was not this particular building. It was another building in York.
It was another building, and that was my thought that I had expressed to the town clerk about using the Voces students to refurbish this house as an experimental
Absolutely.
Laboratory.
Yeah, I mean, at the very least, and I put this in quotes, one should, as a good steward of the historical provenance, the heritage of a given place, is at least take the building apart, catalog all the pieces, catalog the historical structure of the original, catalog the 1860s editions, and see what can be reused. Now, conventionally, what happens is that those components are put into the marketplace. Now, capitalism is an inefficient means to redistribute materials like this, but it would be a good first step if they don't have the wherewithal to turn it into a second living laboratory or a case study for people who want to learn the building arts, that it should at least be carefully taken apart, documented on the way down.
There is quite a bit of salvage that is possible in this house. Besides the normal copper plumbing fixtures and things of that matter, there are wide floor planks that a lot of people would love to put in.
I'm
their
smacking
houses.
My lips over the hand-hewn beams. I mean, those sound fantastic.
I'll send you some pictures.
That would be great. Do you have a blog where people can see pictures of this or anything like that?
I have my own blog site, which is HudsonRiverArchitecture.com.
Cool. If you could put some up there, that would be great to see. I'd love to see that.
I can put a couple photos there.
That would be super.
The article on the house is located at NorthCountyNews.com. Uh-huh. Which shows the front elevation of the house back in, I would guess, the 1950s or so, with the tower structure still attached.
Yeah, before it burned down, or probably. Yeah, sure.
We also discussing among myself, the town clerk, the town assessor, who labeled the building as condemned, as having no value whatsoever. The school facility.
No. Who made it? Who said it was condemned? What, the building inspector?
The town assessor.
Oh, the town assessor. We have a special place for them because they're only talking about the real estate market. They're blind to history. Yeah. Well. Okay, the assessor's not here to defend him or herself, but that's okay.
There's a great sign in the local Peekskill tax assessor's office that arguing with the tax assessor is like arguing with a pig. Sooner or later, you figure out that it's a waste of your time and that the pig actually enjoys arguing.
Okay. Well, I hope that you could become a spokesperson for doing the right thing in terms of the stewardship that is implied by the fact that that is there and it's owned by a public agency. Now, elsewhere...
One of the problems, speaking of your public agency, one of the problems in doing the estimate for the reconstruction of the house is that it is on school property. Any contractor that works on that property has to be insured, it has to be licensed, and it would probably be unionized as well, paying prevailing wages, which adds to the cost of the house.
So you're saying that a volunteer organization would be prohibited from doing any work on this house?
It's possible. A suggestion was made to subdivide the property out from the school district property and possibly donate it to a local organization to fix up or restore it back to its residential nature, such as like a Habitat for Humanity type house. Habitat does do restoration work using donated labor.
Or let the superintendent of schools live there.
Mm. I I don't think so.
The possibilities are practically endless. Now, I wanted to talk about good stewardship. Last autumn, I was very happy to be able to go to a concert. Richard Thompson, the folk rocky guy who's still around, gave a really awesome concert at your theater there in Peekskill.
The Paramount Theater, in downtown Peekskill.
I mean, it's a gem. But I could tell from the restoration attempts that it had seen some better days. Although I have to say that it's presently a somewhat a threadbare opulence. It's really a nice mix between all spiffed up and fancy new and something that's old and been around for a while. Was that abandoned for a while, that theater?
It was, I would say, underutilized. It was not attracting a lot of the population to come see the events. It also, the city of Peekskill also helped turn around the downtown area by taking all the vacant stores and office space that were on the second and third floors and turned them into live-work lofts for artists of many types. Part of that was the theater crowd.
And the city did that?
They did this in the city. Primarily, a lot of the second floors, third floors, fourth floors were converted into open space lofts, one bedroom, two bedroom, or just plain working studios.
But were these conversions done by private parties and the city of Peekskill just didn't get in their way, or was there city money that facilitated this?
I believe they hired a coordinator.
Uh huh.
To get the local landowners and landlords to get grants to improve their properties.
Excellent. That's a really nice success story of a ground roots effort that turned around a city that had gotten to be rather an unfriendly place. I mean, I found it really, actually rather delightful to be there on a Saturday night. Felt rather safe. It was nice to see so many people on the streets. And I'm sure that you've been very happy with these developments since you lived there.
It's very quiet at night. It doesn't have all the bells and whistles and noises of New York City.
Yeah, well, there is no place like New York City.
It actually quiets down at night. We're a bedroom community, basically.
But you do have these events happening, so.
And we do have a lot of summertime open air, open street festivals. We had a Italian festival that attracted over 4,000 people in one particular day. Recently, we had HBO come and film a mini-series in the downtown area. They converted storefronts back to 1935 Los Angeles to film a five-part mini-series called Mildred Pierce. Part one was filmed in downtown Peekskill. And they took the storefronts and turned them into period 1935, they turned it was just a community college, which used to be a former five and dime. They turned it back into a five and dime Kroger's with all the period window displays. They put awnings on the building. They brought in palm trees. They created a hardware store out of a 99-cent store that was currently vacant. They built brand new signs and then aged them to make them look like they had been there for 50 years. They hired local car enthusiasts to bring in their 1910 to 1935, 1940 vehicles and drive them up and down the streets. They brought in buses. They brought in trucks.
So
they had 200 extras in costume.
So what I'm hearing is that if you can hold on to your historical provenance, if you can hold on to your infrastructure that you've had, that life can come around again, and in that way we can all be good stewards of what we've been given in a way that creates new life from something that was there before, which is just a little tiny piece of the world that Bucky Fuller suggested that we should start discovering. Of course, he hasn't brought a solution to famine and poverty by 1995, but we're getting there, piece by piece. One city in the Hudson River Valley can have a resurgence, and piece by piece we can apply our awareness of sustainable reuse of what's there. Don't just tear it all down, to make the world a happy place. Bring life back. Yeah, absolutely.
The trickle down or trickle out.
Or
people that come into the city, take back their knowledge to their local communities or their local homes.
Yeah, building up from the grassroots. I think we've run out of our legal limit here, Tom. I'm terribly sorry. We'll have to have you come back. It's been Burning Down the House, brought to you by Hearst Ranch with Tom Lee. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith. Speak with you again soon.
Thank you, Curtis.
Thank you, Tom.
You
bet.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from the Museum of Food and Drink. Dave Arnold and Patrick Martins have gathered a team of New York's most innovative chefs and bartenders to create a 9-course fundraiser lunch at Del Posto, Sunday, March 27th. Their intent? To kickstart the greatest food museum in the world. The menu for this unprecedented event is derived from educational themes of the museum. Chefs will draw inspiration from sources outside their normal sphere. How will a cutting-edge chef handle the Paleolithic, or a dish only using pre-Columbian ingredients? What will a modern Italian chef do with ancient Rome? The chefs include David Chang of Omofuku, Wiley Dufresne of WD-50, Mark Ladner of Del Posto, Nils Noren of the French Culinary Institute, Cesare Casella of Salumeria Rossi, Carlo Maracci of Roberta's, Brooks Headley of Del Posto, and Christina Tozzi of Momofuku Milk Bar. Bartenders include Audrey Sanders of Pegu Club, Thomas Waugh of Death & Company, Simon Ford of Pernod Ricard, Damon Boltley of Prime Meats, and Eben Clem of BR Guest Restaurants. Proceeds from the event will directly support the Museum of Food and Drink. Tickets are very limited and $250 per person. To purchase tickets, please visit mofad.eventbrite.com. That's mofad.eventbrite.com. Once again, mofad.eventbrite.com. Sponsored by Pernod Ricard, Heritage Foods USA, Pat LaFrieda Meats, Barterhouse Wines, Del Posto Restaurant.
9 times out of 10, when someone is taking the time to break away and do their own thing, it's because they either have a specific point of view or a specific passion that really sort of speaks to maybe not a mass audience, but the customers that I have and the customers that Barterhouse tries to culture and cultivate, I think are those type of people who want that story and feel like if they take an allocation of an 80 case made wine, that they've got something special and it's something that only they have or maybe one other person has. So that's kind of what we specialize in. And, you know, it may not be business savvy to the nth degree, like we're not making 100,000 cases of Pinot Grigio and, you know, flogging them all over New York. But the customers that get wine from us are kind of believing the same stuff we do, which is supporting these small farms, supporting these young winemakers who have a passion for doing it. And we supply them with a market and we allow them to get their product out there to otherwise an untapped group of people.